This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our distinguished guest today is Dr. Gru Brundtland, who is the Mimi and Peter E. Haas Distinguished Visitor at Stanford University. Her remarkable career includes service as Prime Minister of Norway three times. She was the chair of the World Commission on Environment and Development and former Director General of the World Health Organization. She is currently a special envoy with the United Nations and deputy chair of the Elders, a group of distinguished former political leaders concerned about world problems. Dr. Brundtland, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
In looking at your remarkable career, I found three springboards which you identify. Let's talk about them in understanding your achievement. The first is your parents. How did they shape your thinking about the world?
Well, I had very progressive parents who had a very clear view of society and of the world. They were social democrats. They believed in social justice. They believed in equality, also equality between girls and boys, women and men. And they believed that the world was there as a responsibility for all of us, not only our own community or our own country.
And one interesting thing is that although your parents were very progressive, you became aware when you were young that women were not treated fairly in the world and in society.
Yes. As I watched growing up, I noticed many things. There was one example. I was with a girl in my class in her home one afternoon after school. And we were struggling with a mathematics problem. And I said, her mother was there, so I said, can't we go and ask your mother? She looked strange. And the story, of course, is her mother was not educated. Her mother didn't know mathematics at a 11-year level. And I realized, this was an example of many, as I grew up, that I saw how many women were not getting to the level that they could. And also, of course, in every other aspect of life, they were treating girls and boys differently. We even had less mathematics in primary school than the boys had. And we were learning cooking while the girls were doing mathematics. I mean, the boys were doing math. So I knew as I grew up that things were not right. So I made a very clear decision in my mind, this has to change.
Your father was a physician, but also a minister of health and defense minister and of social affairs, I guess, of Norway. And your mother worked in the parliament?
Yeah, she worked for the Labour Party office, and then she moved over to the Labour Party group in parliament and was in their secretariat as a leading clerk and working to help the parliamentarians.
So politics was always on the table at home?
Politics was always discussed. What was right? What was fair? How should society continue to change? What is necessary in the world? All of these issues were at the breakfast table, at the dinner table, as something self-evident for us.
Another important element of the springboard that you were lucky to have was being a Norwegian. So there seems to be something special about Norway in terms of its values and its commitment to its people.
I think, yes, Norway is a very thorough democracy. Although there was inequality between women and men, it was a country with small distances between people's assets. We have had little inequality in terms of high and low level payment, all of those issues. And we had a good democracy. So I grew up in a very homogeneous society where things had come far with regard to health, education, all the basic needs that were for all. So I grew up in that kind of atmosphere. And then when I came to the U.S. as a 10-year-old, I saw something different.
And you were here for a year, and that is where you picked up some of your English, and which you mastered even more later?
Yes, I was lucky as a 10-year-old to come to the U.S. and live in Brooklyn for nearly a year, a whole school year, because it had been, a benefit for me the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I was back 15 years later at Harvard.
And tell us about your experience at Harvard. You've gotten a medical degree, and then you come to the Harvard School of Public Health for a year to get a master's. How did that training contribute to what you became?
When I came, I remember I had some friends of my father who had studied public health at Hopkins. And I was asking, I was curious, what is difficult? What should I try to prepare? Statistics is difficult. Try to read this book from Baldwin. They even remember the name of the book. And that summer before we left, I read it. And it was not so bad. So I kind of gained more confidence before I even entered that when I was 25. But I didn't know exactly the curriculum and so on. So as I moved on, I started in maternal child health because I was a doctor from the University of Oslo. I knew that child health is important for the future of any nation, any society, and of course mother's health as well. So I started majoring in maternal child health. But as that first semester passed and I saw where the best teachers were, and where the most interesting subjects were. It was in statistics, epidemiology, research methodology. So I did as many points or credits or whatever you call it in those areas and just barely passed to be a major in maternal and child health. Although I chose breastfeeding across the world as my thesis for the year. So it was a fascinating year.
And this is why throughout your career, data is very important. So on the one hand, you have your ear to the ground as a political leader, but you are also, what is the evidence? What is the data to show? How good is the data? Do we need to find more data or fund? Talk a little about that, because that's very important in your career.
Yes, it is. It probably is a combined thing about personality, because when I think of my father, a physician, he was always conveying, why do you say that? How do you know that? He was always testing his children about knowing what they were talking about. So it was probably, even genetically, but also as brought up to be systematic and critical about things. So, but then this training at Harvard and how you choose, why do you choose to go into research method? Why do you choose more statistics? It fascinates you. You feel it's important. So I think I built on something that was in me in the start.
Yeah, it's interesting because there are certain qualities of leadership that you demonstrate that continue throughout your career. And there are also certain themes. And one, we can call it luck or reward for job well done. You have carried through on particular topics as you move from one role to another, from one platform to another. And breastfeeding was one of those.
Absolutely. So that, I even have that paper today. It was handwritten, it was before any PCs or any, and I had to use Index Medicus and sit at the library and have the librarian help me get the papers I needed to read. So it has a long reference list. It was a lot of work, and you couldn't get anything on any internet, of course. So, but that 30 or 40 page handwritten paper was about what happens across the world, Why are women breastfeeding some places, not others? And one of the things that really made an impression on me was that mothers in Puerto Rico, that was still a poor place, poor country, they were getting so much influence from American TV that they started using cow's milk and mixing milk bottles instead of breastfeeding. And their children had more diseases, higher mortality, because then, you know, you mess up with unclean water, unclean bottles. And it really made an impression on me that we need to try to change these kinds of habits that are culturally impressed from the outside. And we should try to, you know, kind of base the need for breastfeeding and the right of a woman to breastfeed. So as I moved over to my own country, I said to myself, people who working mothers, they need to be having time free to nurse their baby in the first year. That's a societal duty, in my opinion. So, you know, I worked on this in the coming years, and all the time until WHO in 1981 had a major debate about this. And Norway, under my premiership, supported them to try to stop the advertising industry, pushing more and more artificial formula to more and more mothers across the world.
You go back to Norway and you work in the health ministry, and then you get a call from the prime minister, and he asks you a question which was surprising, what he wanted you to do.
Well, he said, I want you to enter government. And I had no idea that was, you know, a question I could get. I had no plan to become a politician. But, I quickly thought I have to call my husband, my father, to ask advice. Because being asked to serve, you have to find out whether you have a reason to say no. That's how I felt. And as they both supported it, I thought, well, it's your duty to serve. Because, you know, I was always arguing that women should have a bigger role in society. So how could I turn down this challenge from the prime minister? No?
And what was the challenge?
The challenge to enter government.
But as what?
That's the second question. Yeah. The second question was, I was hoping he was asking me to become Minister of Health, of course, which was my profession, what I knew most about. He said, no, I don't want professionals leading ministries. They should be politicians, not bring their professional background into the ministry. So I want you to be Minister of Environment. However, I soon found out the distance between health and environment is not that great. You know, we are concerned about the environment, not least because of people and humanity.
And what's interesting here is that it seems to have been at Harvard that you got this sense of working across disciplines and seeing a bigger picture. And I think you say somewhere that when you became environment minister, that meant taking care of the animals and the trees, I guess. But people weren't as important yet.
Well, I think the perspective of many people who were supporting, you know, the early environment, nature conservation movement, they were focusing on what was happening to nature, what was happening to the flora, the fauna, and that was their focus. And I'm not saying they did not care about people, but I realized as a doctor and a public health expert how important all these issues are for people, for all people, not only locally with local pollution and all of what happens, but even globally, that the sum of human activities affect the environment and then hurt back on people.
There are two turning points, two important elements of your ministry that I want to point out. Very early on, you saw that you had to work with the other administrators,
yes.
that it was cross-disciplinary. So if you're going to work with on environment, then you had to work with the Minister of Industry. You had to work with the budget officer. Talk a little about that. And that, I gather, you got from Harvard. Or did you have it before?
I think I always felt that things are interlinked. Even as a child, I looked for why and where, and I saw the linkages between different aspects of what was around me. And then at Harvard, doing the research methodology and looking across the different disciplines, I continued in that way. But then, as you are a minister, you know that your people, who work for you, they work in different departments. And they focus on one discipline here, another there. And I, as the leader of it all, I have to put together the holistic picture of something. And then at government table, you know, the rule already before I came was that any policy issues that needed government attention or decision, that would have to be placed before the cabinet after having gone around to the other ministries for comment. And that was the only right thing. Otherwise, you don't have a process to prepare decision-making in the right way. So I realized that when I started looking at issues, passing legislation, etc., I had to send to all my colleagues. Many others had fewer to send to. But in my case, nearly always. So I got this general impression, I need to convince as much as possible all my colleagues. One thing is the paperwork and the preparation. Then in the cabinet meeting itself, I engage in the debates on all other issues. Now, I quickly became deputy leader of the party, which, of course, meant that I kind of felt responsible for the whole of the political field.
A second turning point in your career was the first blowout in the North Sea. You had established some rules, and by that set of rules, you were the person in charge of dealing with the blowout. You even brought Adair from Texas. Talk about that, a woman in the public eye dealing with one of the first of its kind that we knew about, namely a blowout of an oil field in a precious resource.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a test in many ways. First of all, I mean, we in the Ministry of Environment were lucky that we had taken the initiative early enough so that there were, in fact, regulations in place in case of such a situation. It had, in fact, been finally passed through the government system and through the king, signed 3 or 4 weeks before that blowout happened. I mean, otherwise, we would have had to make rules, you know, on the way, which would not have been as easy, and it would have been messy with regard to Parliament and also criticism by Phillips Petroleum, because they were given instructions. I mean, I was giving them instructions about what they had to do, and they had to respect it because it was already Norwegian law, and I was in charge. So all of these issues led to, well, first of all, I nearly had no sleep or very few hours of sleep in 8 or 9 consecutive days and nights. And I was losing weight, but my energy level never left me. I learned that under this kind of continuous pressure, I can function. And people saw me functioning. They saw me answering questions by journalists, hundreds of journalists in Stavanger on our western coast, southwestern coast. You know, and I was answering them in English and had control of the facts and knew what I was talking about. Now, the whole thing was something, an experience in my life that I learned things about myself. I learned about the importance of being able to speak to the international press. And the Norwegian people, they liked what they saw. They saw that I knew what I was talking about, and that in Parliament I told the opposition, you all signed up to this legislation. You agreed. Why are you criticizing us? We made this legislation in case there was a blowout or another accident. So the fact that an accident has happened, that's not something to blame us for. The way we deal with it is the way you can blame us. So it was very interesting in so many ways.
One of the issues that you are a visionary and leader on, and we've already talked about this a little, is bringing women into important roles. So in this, you were the environmental minister who knew her stuff, who was dealing with a crisis.
In the energy sector.
In the energy sector.
Yeah.
Right. But you were a woman.
Yeah.
And that was important, wasn't it?
I think it was important. Yeah. Yes, it was important. And there was another, first of all, we wanted the environmental perspective to be the key one, the crucial one, you know, in the balance of things, to protect nature and protect Norway from the consequence. But just as a side thought about that is that at this time, the Minister of Energy was a man about 10 years older than me. He was not educated at the same kind of level. He had not learned English as a 10-year-old. He spoke very little English, in fact. And so, you know, in case the government had decided that he would be in the lead in dealing with the crisis, he would have had great difficulties in responding to the international attention. So, in a sense, he was also lucky. That because this, you know, this was not something fun. I mean, I found it interesting and challenging, but it was not. It was a difficult job, and his younger woman colleague did the job. She also happened to be the deputy leader of the party, which gave me additional kind of stature, you know.
I want to raise an issue here because you point out something that I think is very important for the United States, where we are just recognizing the importance of women in politics and the embracing them for major roles. And you point out that you learn, and this is kind of an aside, that you had, and remember, you're at the cutting edge of all of this. I want to remind my audience. So in essence, you found out that at that time, you realized that the constituents out there didn't know what to do with a tough woman because they thought that being tough went against the grain of what a woman should be.
Well, that was what the opposition tried to make out of it, you know, to help them gain momentum. I mean, when I then became prime minister, and even in the years before when I was a successful Norwegian politician that everyone knew, they tried by using the sexism way of dealing with things and trying to pull me down by using what you would call sexist comments and remarks, trying to undermine a woman at that level. And that happened also in the election campaign when I had been prime minister for 9 months when the election came. Then they used get rid of her. But you see, that sounds like a normal sentence. But in Norwegian, you can write that with the letter A means her, but it also means Arbeiderpartiet or Labour Party. So get rid of A and her, you know, in one go, vote conservative. So they were using the fact that I was a woman.
You, as prime minister, appointed 8 women to the cabinet, which was also a first.
Yeah.
40% of the cabinet, I guess.
Yes.
Was that controversial, or were people ready just to accept that?
It was controversial, but we had worked on it for several years to change the culture, the atmosphere, but also in the party. And we had already made a 40% rule in our party, the Labour Party, and had been decided 3 years before in a party conference. But the rule was unclear. It didn't specify that a Labour Party-based government, that the rules would apply to the government arena. But I felt in my heart and my mind that it would be very strange if we made an exception for the Norwegian government when we had made a rule for anyone elected to any party body. So I took it for granted this was the right thing to do. But it was not everyone even those who had supported the party rule, they thought maybe we could have a little more men in that cabinet, you see? Again, competition between different personalities and interest groups.
Mm-hmm. In courage, you don't second-guess yourself.
No.
Once you know the data or the issue.
Yeah. No, that's right. I mean, I basically followed my convictions in most cases. And that doesn't mean I was not somebody building consensus. I certainly learned how you do that to get things through with small modifications. You can get far. But in certain cases, there is no middle way. You know, we have to make a choice. And on those, I stood my opinion, risking maybe to lose, but finding it the right thing, and it wouldn't matter. Even, you know, if I had done what I could for something I was convinced about, then I would be happy about myself in either case.
The Secretary General asked you to become the chairman of the Global Commission on Environment and Development. Mm-hmm. You had been a prime minister. You had been an environment minister. And I get the sense that you basically, by this time in your career, had a sense of strategy and what it would take to make this work. What were your terms? What were your funding? Who did you want on board?
Yeah, I was convinced that there was no idea to make a global commission, again, discussing environment on its own. Because in Stockholm, 10 years before, Indira Gandhi came to Stockholm and said, poverty is the greatest polluter. So she put the whole development issue on the agenda in Stockholm. And I knew she was right, that there was no way to have a global attention to what needs to be done to change our patterns of development, unless we had the rich world and the poorer world, the developing world, together on this. And that means environment and development. So I said it has to be environment and development. And for that to work, to have commissioners who can deal with that, I need to have a majority from the developing world, because the developing world is the bigger part of the globe. So there were certain key principles that and then they also tried to push onto me a vice chair that some people were thinking could be my co-chair. He was a man from Sudan. And I knew that I had said yes to lead a commission, not to have any wishy-washy things about somebody else, you know, looking over my shoulder and taking care of the woman, you know, because he's a man. So he was my vice chair. We found a way to work together. It was fine. But some people had the strategy then that, you know, control this woman because we need a co-chair who is a male. And that didn't happen.
And also you got independent funding for the commission?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that was obvious that I was not going to be pushed by anyone. So only countries who were willing to fund with no conditions we would receive money from. So there was a group of countries that stood up and said, we are willing to fund this. Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, yeah, basically those. Mm-hmm.
You, as a cabinet minister, had learned the importance of working across portfolios in an interdisciplinary way, we would say, to build coalitions. Mm-hmm. And that's what you had to do here,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. I mean, it was... So we identified the big players in this area globally, you know, industry, the NGO, of course, civil society part, all levels of political decision makers, and the whole educational field. I mean, universities, think tanks, everywhere that education was and research was happening. So we linked up across the world with all of these constituencies. And the business and the industry community, of course, were essential for any development, change in development patterns.
So you put an idea on the global agenda, a very important idea, a real vision, but there's disappointment and frustration in the sense that not everything was implemented. And it seems to be that one of the problems is religion, and those groups, the oil companies, that have an interest in not moving beyond where we are. How, as a political leader, do you learn to accept those realities? You still want to put the vision.
I don't accept them. Yeah. No, I mean,
no,
but I'm still working on them.
You live with it. Yeah, you live with it. Yeah, for the time being.
But I'm working on it. Yeah. No, but you know, there is one aspect here. This is only about 25 years ago. In historical terms, that's a very brief period in human history. And only 5 years after the report of 87, the Rio summit that we had called for and asked to, that should be organized, agreed on the climate convention covering the whole world. They agreed on the Biodiversity Convention and something called Agenda 21. That's very unusual in political international history. Then, 5 years after that, you had Kyoto, trying to control the emissions of CO2 and other global warming emissions. And so that was high pace in international terms. Now then, we have seen how we stumble in the international community in the implementation of all of these very important issues. However, you know, in the big conference in Copenhagen 2009, where everyone was expecting some kind of global agreement, there was a total breakdown because countries came at the leadership level and said no, from so many different perspectives. The puzzle was not put together in a way that made it possible for countries to agree on something. But one thing was saved that night, and that was the conference agreed no more than 2 degrees Celsius or 3 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit is an acceptable increase in global warming by 2050. Now the world is trying to do what that means. And we have still not found the way, but things are moving in the right direction. You know, it's the Secretary General has called leaders across the world together in September to tell the world what they are willing to do at their own national level. And together you can sum up what everyone will maybe be able to say, and it will probably be not more than maybe 50% up to what we need, but it pushes everyone to do more and inspires the process. We don't have much more time left, but maybe in the Paris meeting in 2015, you know, if you move those 50 up to 75, then things are really going to be better than where we are now on climate.
As Prime Minister, during your tenure, the question came up, would Norway join the EU? And I'm curious about that, and the Norwegians voted no. And what I'm interested in is, this is where the tire hits the road in a way. On the one hand, analysis and data, these are the reasons why we should join. But politics is also about passion and interest and feeling threatened, say, the fisheries interest. Talk a little about that, because you've got to weigh these and accept the fact that you may lose.
Mm. Yeah. I had a discussion with Jacques Delors, who was the EU Commission boss, and a French, very capable leader of the EU Commission. He visited Norway in 1986, and we discussed the future. I took up with him what kind of relationship with the EU can Norway, Sweden, and Finland get, and Iceland. because EFTA, which is what's called, was kind of losing out. The European Commission or Union became greater and greater, and they had introduced something called the internal market, which was the rules of the whole area of Europe. And if we could not be part of the internal market anymore, we would really get into trouble. We are an exporting country. So is Sweden. So I was discussing how we could, and we came up, because I was convinced Norway would say no again if we had raised the issue of membership. And I was convinced in 86. I remained convinced until we, in the final stages, had to fight that war anyway. But so what happened was that as we were working on creating something new, the European Economic Area, the negotiations were difficult. There even was a government downfall in Norway in the middle of it. I had to take over government for the third time because the conservative government with the center could not manage because of the agricultural businesses and the difficulty, agricultural sector. Now, then one day, Ingvar Carlsson from Sweden calls me late at night at around 12 o'clock. Gro, I have to tell you that in the morning the news will come that we have committed to seek membership of the European Union. We, meaning Sweden, under the Labour government in Sweden. They had been pushed by the Conservative Party in order to get a budget through. And the whole perspective and vision of getting all these countries into the European Economic Area, which is what Norway, I thought, could tolerate no more, that broke down that night. And it was politics in my neighboring country. So, in fact, we had to also apply. Otherwise, it would have looked very strange. But I knew it was very risky. But we just had to do it to try to save even the kind of negotiations that had been going on. And then that was kind of the issue, that then we did everything we could to convince the Norwegian people that it would be the right choice. Sweden was probably joining. Finland was probably joining. We should also be part of a broader European community. Yeah. Then Norway said no. But I also said very clearly during that campaign, because people were asking, what do you do, the government, what do you do with your government if you get a no in the referendum? I said, we will do whatever the country needs. We are going to respect the answer of the Norwegian people. This is not what happened 20 years before under a former Labour government. Because, and then the Labour government said, we will step down in case there is a no. But I always felt that that was kind of threatening people. You know, if you're a Labour member or a Labour Union member, and your Prime Minister says, if you don't vote yes, I am leaving, in fact, it's a threat. You are not giving them full respect to make their own opinion. So that's how I saw it. So we stayed, and people knew we would stay. Now, some who were criticizing us said, if Gro had just said she will leave, she would have won. I don't think so, but nobody can ever prove. That night, when the no was a fact, you know, I went late to bed. Next morning at 7, I went up to the office, and I started planning, what's the future for Norway after the no? The people had spoken. I respected it. We went on.
So politics, as the former Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, said, is always local in some regard. Your next assignment was, after you decided, we should emphasize here, you decided you're ready to leave. Mm-hmm. After 15 years in the party, and so you said, enough isn't, this is the end.
Yeah.
And so it was time to move on to a new platform, and you were fortunate to be asked. Mm-hmm. by the Secretary General to become head of the World Health Organization.
Well, what happened was he asked me to be his deputy Secretary General. But he also knew that the election process of WHO was going on. So it would have been either one of those two then. But I stepped down not because I wanted to move on, but because I wanted to open the space for those who were younger than me. And then I step aside, and my next thing was not on my mind. You know, it was more the right time to leave is now.
It's interesting, because just an aside here, you say somewhere that you were in a plane ride with Margaret Thatcher, and you ask her about supporting, you know, who are the women that are rising, and she basically said, there are none. And you drew a conclusion from that, which makes you very different from her.
I was surprised, because what she said was, there are not many qualified women to select from. And I said, but don't you have a number of women parliamentarians? Well, she kind of shook her head and said, well, I have to pick the best people. She was not ready to really think, how can I promote women who have potential? And unless you do that, how are we going to change a pattern of gross inequality between men and women? So she had a very different perspective from mine.
When you went to the World Health Organization, you really were able to bring everything together in a funny kind of way. The emphasis on research, the emphasis or the experience of crisis management, the experience of being a prime minister who has to consolidate coalitions. So what did you set out to do? You had a vision, right?
Well, I looked, of course, at what the World Health Organization was doing. I looked at the global perspective of health, the prevention, the treatment of illnesses. And, of course, you know, it's an enormous agenda out there needing to be done. So I realized that I have to bring the health sector up to the attention of prime ministers and finance ministers, not only health ministers, who often sit far down at the table, who have too small budgets, and their health issues are not always on the agenda of the leaders. So I had to move health onto the global agenda, which I had done with environment and development in the years of the commission and the following years. So I looked at the way we could manage to do that. I went to Davos at the World Economic Forum. I spoke there about the importance of global health, also for productivity. Investing in health is important for the economy. You know, it's not only a human rights issue. So all of this, I knew we had to politicize the whole thing, get them up to the global agenda, and also make some changes about getting much more funding into these areas. Childhood vaccination had gone down. During the 90s, there was a lower percentage than early 90s when I came in. And, you know, childhood vaccination is one of the most effective health interventions you can do. So I spoke out on this, and we were mobilizing people. Also the civil society and the philanthropic community like Bill Gates. So he played a role in also opening up for new types of institutions, combining the private and the public sectors. So this led to an enormous new added perspective and also much more funding going into childhood vaccination.
And you brought in Jeffrey Sachs to establish a microeconomics and health issue.
So what I said about health investment, you know, health is an investment in prosperity, not only a cost. So Jeffrey Sachs was asked to lead the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health to convince the finance ministers across the world about the key importance of health. And of course, his documentation and the group of people he with our help, pulled together, made an excellent report. It helped us in doing this.
So what you're really, as a strategist, and I'll say you're a remarkable strategist at this point, you're identifying the weaknesses in the organization, you're identifying the vision and the data that you need to actually bring the organization
to another level.
And interestingly enough, politics is not a bad thing for you. Because it's only if you understand the politics in all these different countries that have to sign on that you're going to achieve something.
Yeah, right. And the other issue, which is linked to what you asked me about the School of Public Health, is that the one important key aspect of the World Health Organization is to be the center of excellence in global health, the place where people can get the correct data. Now, that needed to be improved. And so Julio Frank from Mexico, he became the leader of a new cluster, that we called it, which was called Evidence for Health, Evidence for Public Health. So he created, we were able to get funding and to improve, you know, kind of the basic assumptions, that knowledge base, and improve the research base and the gathering of evidence, which again let us move more quickly in other areas. Tobacco was another major issue that I took from the beginning, because it was one of the major mortality reasons across, and it was, the trend was like this, but very little was being done except in the OECD countries, which were taking care of their own interests and their own populations by many of them having good legislation, including the U.S. But others were just suffering the impact of the tobacco companies coming out with all their advertising and their money across the world to inspire new populations to start the smoking habit.
When you were Secretary General of WHO, the SARS epidemic hit. So this was a case where you could draw on your experience.
Certainly was.
Oil blowout to SARS. Mm-hmm. And what were you, do you think you were positioned to do because of all of this experience?
Well, you know, one Sunday I was called by one of the key people in my office telling to me that they had had meetings earlier that weekend because there were some strange diseases, examples of illness in the Far East that they had to study quickly because to try to see how they can contain. So I came into the office that evening and had our first meeting going through everything that the professionals had been gathering across the world. And the thing was quickly quite scary because it started spreading. And very early in that following week, there were cases going from China, Hong Kong, into Vietnam, and new cases were spreading in a hospital in Vietnam. And then a lady, a Canadian, who had been in, I think, the Philippines, she went back to Toronto, a new round of cases in Toronto. So I said, we must do something globally here. We cannot sit and see this disease, although we don't know what it is yet. It's a new disease. Nobody knew exactly what. But 1 out of 10 were dying from it. There was panic in the different. So they said, well, the only thing we can do, the experts were saying, is it means having to stop the aviation industry, because what spreads this disease is sick people getting on airplanes and spreading it to other parts of the world. So I said, well, this, I don't care. We have to do what's right. If people are going onto airplanes, not knowing that they are at great risk of dying from it, we have to do something. We have to tell people. So we came up with travel recommendations very quickly. And so the WHO makes a travel recommendation explaining about the disease, the danger of the disease, how it has to be contained, and that people should not travel to this, 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 and this airport. And as we added new countries to that list, there were people, you know, in the airline industry and others who started making noises. Of course, we could not command, but people did not dare. The nations realized they have to support the WHO. So they didn't dare to say, no, no, you go, because we don't care about it. They didn't dare that. So, in fact, it became a global system of recommending where you should not go. And within 4 months, we were able to contain the whole disease. It had spread to 15 or 20 different places, and each little epidemic could have become a pandemic. But by containing each one with quite tough measures, having people stay at home for 10 days so they wouldn't infect other people, every single epidemic was stopped across the world. And the disease was gone. Because, you know, it cannot spread when the virus cannot move from one human being to the next. And meanwhile, after a month, our scientists across the world had identified what this new virus was. A coronavirus that we named SARS. It was a fascinating challenge, I must say.
In your career, you've stood on the shifting templates. On the one side, the passion of people who are focused on religion, on atavistic ideas. I'm not saying religion is, but just ideas. Mm-hmm. And on the other, research data.
Yeah.
This is what the research tells us,
yeah.
You know, about why, say, family planning would be a good thing. Talk a little about that. I mean, what have you learned in navigating that?
So when I really, felt challenged by it and wondering a lot about how to deal with it was during the World Commission on Environment and Development, during those 3 years. Because there were people on my commission who said, when we were formulating our recommendations on family planning, because, of course, population was part of the whole issue of environment and development and the role of women, etc. They said, well, according to my religion, I cannot sign up to this. So we had some patients. We made more material available. We waited until the next meeting, spoke individually with each one. I did with each one of them. And it turned out that they knew that what we were planning to write was right. But how were they going to explain in their country that they had signed up to something that was politically difficult or impossible for them at home, because it was a Catholic country or a Muslim country, whatever? So I had kind of to think that, can I convince these people as individuals about their responsibility to take seriously the evidence in front of them? Like I had to do, others had to do, on evidence that was not all of it nice for your own country. We were supposed to be independent global leaders, not representing one country. So in the end, although one person left, but that were, I think, for several reasons. I mean, I don't know really. But the rest of the group decided in the end that they could side with a big majority. And we managed to get everyone on board. And it meant that for the world, as international discussions went on, in the preparations for Cairo, population conference in Cairo, which was a few years later, we had already given the picture that an international group can agree on crucial assessments of the need for women to be participating in communities, to be able to decide on their own futures, to decide on the size of the number of their children, the spacing of their children. So that became more normal. And it helped also Cairo get to good conclusions.
One final question. If students are watching this interview, how would you advise them to prepare for the future and the kind of challenges the world is going to face in their studies, in their temperament, and so on.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to know each person to give really good advice. However, you know, if you listen to your own convictions and you follow some, you know, the knowledge base, and you extend your knowledge base, and you have your passion and your interest, and you find out where do you tick, what is engaging you, then move in those directions, because every individual can contribute in one way or the other. But probably more if you learn to listen to your own inner conviction and to listen to others, because it's only when we can link up and have together found solutions that the world can move forward. So those are the things I discuss with young people today. So don't listen to others, but never forget to listen to your own inner convictions, because then you will not be passionate. You will not have the drive to do whatever you start doing and then learn from others all the time.
Dr. Brundtlin, on that note, I want to thank you very much for coming to Berkeley and sharing your intellectual odyssey and your remarkable career with our audience. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.